Welcome back to another edition of Kinda Christian. Now, we've all heard the phrase, the power of prayer and God heals. And frankly, sometimes it's hard to believe because, let's be honest, we all know people have probably prayed for something, maybe a healing, and it didn't come true. That's why I really enjoyed this interview with Pastor Obed Martinez. Now, he's the lead pastor of Destiny Church out in Palm Springs, and he opens up and gets pretty vulnerable about some times when he saw God do some crazy things and some times when it didn't pan out. And I think it's a really healthy discussion. Pastor Obed shares his wisdom for how he found God and even shares his own radical encounter with God, which forever changed his life. So regardless of where you arrive at some of these things, I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. So welcome, Pastor Obed Martinez. Pastor, thanks for being here, man.
Absolutely. It's such an honor to be with you today.
Oh, an honor. All right. It's an upgrade. No one said it's an honor yet. So absolutely. I know. It is 111 degrees outside. And spirits are high, and so is the temperature. So I am thankful to be inside here talking with you. I want to start off, how long have you been a Christian?
Living for Christ, I got saved when I was 16. I'm 46. I was born and raised in a Christian home. That doesn't mean a lot, but at the end of the day, I was able to see two parents that really lived their faith out. And I think at the end of the day, there came a time when I was challenged and failed miserably and really chose a different path for my life that kind of ended with me being incarcerated and then obviously having a lot of time to really think about the choices. It made me realize that God doesn't make bad people. It's that bad people are just a result of bad choices. And that's what happened to my life.
All right. So you were, I did not know this, you were incarcerated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, we do want to hear that story.
Yeah.
I do. Before we get into that, I ask, what does it mean? So when you say you're a Christian, have been a Christian, what does that actually mean to you?
I think at the end of the day, growing up in church, living, pretty much on my mom and dad's faith and, leaning on them instead of leaning on Christ. And that's what a young child does. There comes a time when, your faith has to become, real to you. You can't have just a knowledge of it, but you need an experience from it. And I think I went through a time in my life where the knowledge wasn't good enough and it didn't solve all my answers that I had. So I drifted and went looking and went on a search. And I think that's what we all do sometimes that leads us into paths that we thought we would never go. And it was at 16 years old. Four days, after I got out of prison on a Monday, it was a Friday that I went to camp. And I went just really to please my mom. And I had an experience with God. And that was when my faith became real to me. I wouldn't say it was never real. It became real to me.
Now, has anyone optioned the story or can we hear about this experience?
Yeah. My mother would visit me every weekend. She never drove the interstates or the freeway. We call them in California. And so she would take the bus to come visit me in jail. And every weekend she was faithful to it. And when I got out, she asked me and could I do her one favor? And that was to go to camp. And not knowing that my mom paid her last $60 because my dad was on strike. My dad was an LA Fire Department firefighter, and they were on strike at that time. And she used the last $60 that she got to clean the house to send me to camp. And that night I was there, and, the youth pastor, I was sitting in the back, and he says, there's a seat in the front row. We'd love for you to be there. And I guess he was just trying to make me comfortable, and I went and again, that intimidation rose up. I saw some young people in the front row really, expressing their faith in worship by lifting hands or singing with such great passion. And that wasn't me. And I convinced myself at that moment that wasn't me. And the truth was that I was intimidated by something I know that was really authentic that I had not yet experienced. And our youth pastor went up there and said, if you love Jesus, just lift your hands, and the rest was history.
So you just, when you say an experience with God, did God meet you there? Did you feel something?
Yeah. You know, I lifted my left arm up, and it was an unusual experience. I never had felt nothing like that in my life. I've heard people say, I feel the Holy Spirit, or I feel Jesus. And honestly, I used to probably be the biggest mimic. You know, we used to come home and play church, you know, because that's all we were able to do in some sense. And we would mimic those things, and joke around about them. And I believe God knew what he had to do with me. I believe he knew he had to have an experience with me where I would feel him, where my life in some sense would be transformed by no one's preaching or no one's touch. And, you know, the preaching hadn't taken place yet. Worship just ended. No one had laid hands on me. And it was just one of those real experiences that, again, it doesn't happen to everybody. And that's what I always like people to know. But I really believe God gives you an experience and it becomes your experience. And my experience may not be your experience.
So you just, it was this feeling then, if you were to boil it down, it was a feeling that something came over you that was different.
Yeah.
Than...
And I remember explaining this to my mom. I lifted my hands and I felt like a dam break inside of me. And I could not stop crying uncontrollably. I was sobbing for 2 hours. And how I knew it was 2 hours, because when I looked up, the rest of the group was on their knees crying and people were seeking God. And I remember looking at my watch and it had been 2 hours, and it was like as if I got lost somewhere.
And you're not the guy, I mean, you just gotten out of jail, right? So you're not the guy who's going to be crying for 2 hours in front of people.
No. And again, cynical, in some degrees, sarcastic in some, and again, going back to what I had said, I believe that God knew I needed an encounter with him, for that faith to become more real to my life than just the faith I was living by with my parents.
So when people hear these stories, on one hand, this experience was so powerful that you still talk about it today, 30 years later.
Yeah.
You're still transformed by this experience.
Yeah.
To a skeptic who might say, well, you were overrun with emotion, you had just had a traumatic point in life, you had just gotten out of jail. What do you say when people doubt experiences like that?
You know, I one of the things that I always tell people is we can argue the Bible all day, but we can't argue an experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to argue someone's experience that they may have, whether it was death, or whether it was a loss of a friend or a loss of a relationship. One of the things I love about Jesus is that he validates people's feelings. He may not validate their actions, but he validates their feelings. And, you know, that's found in the story of Mary and Martha when he comes to the tomb of Lazarus. He validates both of their feelings, but he doesn't validate their thought or their opinion of what and why he showed up 4 days late. And at the end of the day, if my experience to a skeptic, in some degree can be argued, then that's something they're going to have to deal with. My experience is my experience. And that's why I'm saying the thing that I love about Paul the Apostle was that he never went around saying, hey, in order to be saved and to come to the knowledge of Christ, you have to ride on a donkey and be knocked off of it, and then 3 days be blind. And I think some of the danger out there when it comes to faith is often we turn experiences into doctrine. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that I just believe everybody has their own experiences. It's why it's a personal relationship with Jesus Christ.
So would you say, if you were to look back, and you're right, you can't, no one's going to convince someone that what they experienced or did not experience, it may not even matter, right? But would you argue then that, hey, let's look at the result down the line, and if an experience is followed by a significant transformation, then it almost doesn't matter how real it was, right? Because it led to a real transformation, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, sometimes it's hard for me. We have Celebrate Recovery here at the church, and sometimes it's hard for me to wrap my head around somebody who's committed to a 12-step program. And at the end of the day, do it day after day, week after week. But you're convinced of their discipline and their transformation when you see that new person, you know, 12 months later, 24 months later, you know, 10 years later. It's very difficult to doubt the experience when you see the fruits right in front of you. And I think at the end of the day, be a skeptic as long as you can until those fruits become a reality in your life.
Yeah. So since we're talking about experience here, and I know a lot of detractors from Christianity would say, well, there's, if they walked into, I guess a good example would be like the Azusa Street Revival, which took place, you know, it was almost 100 years ago. And the newspapers are reporting that people are dancing and talking in strange tongues and they're laying all over the ground. And people think this is just crazy, right? So, but as a pastor and someone who's been a Christian for this long, would you say that these experiences are, I mean, these, there's a real things that happen in Christianity. Like there's just things we can't explain that go on.
Yeah. And Ryan, I was one of them, you know. I'll never forget sitting in our church as a young boy. Our Sunday school teacher was absent that Sunday, and we had to sit with mom and dad in church, and, these people start giving these words out. And so they were so spot on.
What do you mean? When you say giving words out, you're
like
sitting there.
Like they were saying, like, you know, worship had ended, and they were saying, you know, kind of these words of exhortation. And it was like three or four in the congregation, and there's 1,000 people in this auditorium. So I lean over to my mom and I tell her, wow, did the pastor give them all scripts? Because they're all saying the same thing, mom. And she's like, oh, no, no, that's the work of the Holy Spirit. And I'm like, wow, you know? And so I understand from an outside perspective where somebody can be skeptic and somebody can look at that and go, man, that just logically doesn't make sense. And I think, you know, the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 11, verse 3, he says, by faith, Enoch understood. And I think it's really hard to understand the things of faith if you're not in faith. But from an outside perspective, yeah, I mean, and I would encourage that skeptic to chase after it as you would chase after anything that you were skeptical of, that you knew in some sense there may be some truth in this. I mean, that's why I love, you know, the way church is today. I love our church because at the end of the day, we always say that, you know, man, all we're asking you each week is just take another step. We're not asking you to transform because that's not our job. But our job really is just take another step. And we're all in different steps when it comes to faith and in life. And what I may call someone's bluff on and being skeptic of their change in their life today might radically change for me 2 years from now, because I had an experience that brought about that change that at one time I was skeptical about.
Oh, man. So you mentioned words of exhortation. So in the Christian church, there are mentions of miracles, miraculous answers to prayer, healings, people knowing things about people they couldn't have known, prophecy, the idea of, you know, knowing things about potentially about the future via the Holy Spirit. Is that stuff, in your experience, real? And is that something that you have interacted with or know people who have interacted with?
Yeah.
I know it's a big point of division in a lot of churches,
yeah,
about whether or not that stuff kind of happens today.
You know, and again, I go back to your own experiences. And again, I would never, you know, put that on somebody. You know, I drive down Highway 111 here in the desert and I pass by a lot of card reading stores. People are walking in there because they understand there is another world. There's a supernatural world out there. And they go and look for it. And because they want to be told, they want some assurance of what their future can look like. And so I don't hold prophecy only within the realm of the church. You know, people are searching for it every day. That's why these tarot stores are still in business today. You know, they're having to pay their rent. You know, if not, then, you know, it would be a sign that nobody was looking for something like that. So, so I think when it comes to miracles and it comes to prophecy, it goes back to that place and those people. You know, I remember when my sister got healed of lupus, and the doctors, my sister was on dialysis 3 times a week.
Wow.
And God absolutely healed her. We got the documentation from the doctor, everything. It was a real, genuine miracle.
So you prayed for her, and there was like not medicine. It was just, she was being treated. No, not a good prognosis. And then you prayed for her, and she was healed.
Yes. And she got prayed for. I didn't pray for her, but she got prayed over, and God miraculously touched her.
Wow.
My sister goes a few years without treatments, and her liver is great. Her pancreas is great. Her organs are great. And I'm driving home one night, and from the movies with, at that time, my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and we get a call and says, Debbie's been rushed to the hospital. She has a brain aneurysm. And so we go to the hospital, and we're like, hey, God, if you healed her 3 years ago, yeah, you can heal her now. And we prayed for her, and she was on a ventilator, and the doctor says, if there's no change and no brain activity, then you guys are going to have to make the toughest decision. And I remember the next day going to the church, because my offices were there. And there was the knock on the door, and I was the only one there, and a lady comes, and she has a bandana wrapped around her head. And she goes, I'm looking for a pastor to pray for because I have surgery tomorrow. They're going to get a tumor out of my brain. And Ryan, everything inside of me wanted to laugh because I'm like, God, you're humorous. You know what I'm looking for right now.
Like today, really?
And always in my life of being transparent and authentic that I truly love to live by, I looked at her and I said, I can't help you. Because my sister right now is on a ventilator, and we're going to have to probably make the most toughest decision. And I don't have the faith to pray for you. And she looked at me and she says, well, will you just agree with me? The Bible says, if two or three agree. And I said, I can do that. And mm-hmm. She prayed. The next day, that morning, we make the biggest decision, and my sister goes home to be with the Lord. And that afternoon, while we're at my house, I get the phone call from the church secretary that said, were you the person that prayed for this woman yesterday? And I said, well, I didn't pray for her. And I told her the story. She goes, well, she went to the doctors and the tumor's gone. They flew her in a helicopter to another place and got a second opinion, and the tumor's gone. And I can tell you that it led me down a spiral of confusion.
Yeah.
Of God, how come you healed her and not my sister? My brother, who was diagnosed at 7 years old with cystic fibrosis, the doctors told our family he wouldn't live past 11. And my mother, I'll never forget, coming home, and she had the test results, and she brought us all in the living room, and she said, whose report are we going to believe? We're going to believe the report of the Lord. And my mother was a great woman of faith. And my brother lived till he was 25, graduated with 2 master's degrees from UCLA, and fulfilled every dream, okay? But he was 1 hour away from a lung transplant. I'm at USC Medical Center with my cousin and my uncle, who's going to each give up a lobe of their lung to my brother. My brother's at Long Beach Memorial, and I get the phone call that your brother's organs are failing. My brother, we said goodbye to my brother, knowing that the next time he wakes up, he's going to breathe just like us. And next thing you know, my brother goes into cardiac arrest and dies. And again, it left me down a spiral of confusion until a year later. I'm golfing at the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation with USC Medical Center, and I'm with his case manager. And we're at a hole, and he tells me, he says, Obed, in my final interview with your brother, I don't know if he ever shared this story with you, your brother never wanted to know the day he would die. It was his biggest fear. And a lung transplant is the only open-air transplant in your body. And so the longevity isn't that long. It's 2 to 10 years. And as much as I think your brother wanted new lungs, I think God really answered his prayer by taking him home. because at the end of the day, he would have known the day he would die. And so these experiences that I had that questioned God, questioned who and how and what when it comes to miracles, I've been down that path. But at the end of the day, I still wake up and the sun is in its place. The birds are still chirping. I got oxygen in my body. I got breath in my lungs. And I cannot deny the fact that God is still God. And even though it may not have been what I wanted, or maybe what I wanted to experience, or what I believed for, by no means do I feel like God's failed me, more than I believe that God strengthened me for somebody that's even listening right now.
Wow. Man, how do you even begin to unpack that? Like, prayer is such a huge part of a Christian's life. How do you approach that when you've seen a miraculous healing with your sister, only to have it fail in a sense a couple years later, or change, right? And then have a woman, a complete stranger. I mean, God, that sounds like a really weird sense of humor for God to send
yeah,
in.
Yeah, right.
And she gets miraculously healed. How do you wrestle it? God, you healed this woman, but you took my sister and my brother away. How does a pastor and work that out?
You know, Ryan, I wasn't a pastor at that time. I was an evangelist. I had a consulting company. And if I would have told you at that time that one day I would be a pastor, I would tell you there's no way that I would ever do that, because sitting down with pastors and having a consulting company, I was usually brought in because of the problems that would happen. But looking back now, it strengthens my faith, because God was preparing me for what he had prepared for me. I didn't know that. I didn't know I'd end up in the desert pastoring a church, starting a church. But that was part of my preparation, and walking with families that have gone through disappointments and have gone through setbacks and have gone through where their hopes were so high that God can intervene and yet never did. There's that humanity side that I can give them, as well as the faith side. And I tell people all the time, when they lose a loved one — I lost my mom, my brother, and my sister, all in a matter of 4 years. And I said, it never gets easy. It's just that every year we get stronger. And that resonates with people. And at the end of the day, I don't think people are often looking for the logical answer. I think they're just looking for a pathway to heal, because they know they're never going to get that person back. Mm-hmm.
So God is all good, right?
Mm-hmm.
God is good. So you said, you know, sunshine and birds chirping, no matter what happened, God is still God. So, and that means he's good. He's in charge. How does one work out then what we see? I mean, so many tragic things happen. And I know the philosophical argument, you can't call something bad if there isn't a good to compare it to. But how do you work out the fact that God just is in charge of all this, but just allows it, and he seems to pick, you know, who and when he's going to heal, and it seems to be without any real consistency? He must have a reason? Are we supposed to lean on that?
Well, at the end of the day, this is what makes us humans, and the fact that we are still in need of a God who is always in control. You know, I go back to really the beginning, that one of the greatest things that God ever gave man, until this day still gives man, is choice. Mm-hmm. And when God created man, he just didn't say it was good. He said it was very good. This is a very good creation I created, man. This man is born in the image of me and carries my likeness, and gave us that choice. And the one thing that I always tell our congregation is that God didn't create bad people. It's that bad choices is what takes a good person to a bad person. Mm. And still, that one good choice that they can make by turning their lives over to Christ can turn that bad person back to a good person. God doesn't lose control. He allows things to happen. And again, those are the choices of people. Mm-hmm. And yet at the end of the day, when we look at the scriptures and we study them, we realize that miracles were really for the unbelievers. It was really for the person that didn't believe, that needed this type of moment where they would realize he is God. And I think sometimes as Christians, we think we need a miracle, when in all reality, we should have faith. And knowing that now that, let's say I was sick in my body, yeah, I think we should call on the elders of the church, anoint him with oil and lay hands on the sick. Absolutely. But ultimately, it's going to be God who's going to make the decision. And it's a win for both. At the end of the day, my brother didn't get new lungs on earth, but he got new lungs in heaven, you mm-hmm. know? So we were the ones left at loss. But for my brother, it was a win. For my sister, we were left at loss. But still, my sister went where she desired to be, ultimately, and she just beat us there. Now, was that accidental? Was it providential? I don't know. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I just know that God is still in control, and it's all I can trust.
So how do you work that out as far as how much God is in control of our lives? Choice is really important. I guess I'm asking, how do you decide what to sort of inquire or, you know, pray about, and what is God, how involved is God in your life? You know, you might say, oh, well, picking a person to marry, that seems like something that would be very high on his priority list, you know, family decisions, where to go to school, all the way down to, you know, what do I have for breakfast?
Yeah, right.
So what is, if we have choice, where does choice and God's intervention collide?
Yeah, and I think where it really collides is your soul. It is the connector to your body and your mind. And when I look at, you know, when God said to man, or when God said, you know, I will create a woman to be the helpmate for the man, he really didn't give no description, you know. Again, that's choice. You know, do you like brown hair? Do you like blonde hair? Do you like blue eyes? Do you like brown eyes? I don't think God is into those details. I think he is looking at that person as he does all of us. God created us equally, but he designed us distinctively. Mm. And at the end of the day, sometimes we get that confused that, you know, when I was a singles pastor, you know.
There's a title, there's a singles pastor?
Yeah, yeah. And trust me, I was successful because I had about 25 and I ended with two. You know what I mean?
So, pastor, your metric of success is a diminishing congregation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the only
smaller
congregation that should be part of the congregation. That is that should be going the opposite direction.
Singles pastor.
But
okay.
But you know, we would get into these talks, and you know, it got to a point where it was like, listen, if you can't get past my eyes, you're not going to get to my heart. Mm. And I think Christians sometimes over-spiritualize things like, man, I just love the way they worship and that's what I'm attracted to. Well, that's not going to arouse you, okay? So at the end of the day, God created for man to recreate, and you have to be attractive to them. And, you know, you want to take care of yourself. You want her to take care of herself. And we muddy the waters. And one of the things that I always tell young people that are looking for a mate, I said, look it, if they fit your future, you got to make that choice. And it's what I did with my wife. You know, my wife, she loved the Lord. I loved the Lord. Okay, well, that's a good start. You know, she was attractive. I'm attractive to her. That's a good start. But what ultimately led to the decision to say, we're in this, and we dated for 9 years.
We dated for 9 years before you got married?
Yeah.
Whoa.
We were high school sweethearts, college sweethearts, and got married.
All right, so why did you put that off?
So great question. I was 18, she was 16. I went off to college. Mm-hmm. She then graduated, went to college. And because we knew we were going to marry each other, there was 2-3 weeks we didn't talk to each other because we were in final exams or we were in study groups. But there was this, we knew we were meant to be with each other. Not that we had this epiphany moment, but because we decided that our futures fit, and we're attracted to each other, and we really believe that God, you know, brought us together in some sense. And so we never had to worry about relationships, what other relationships went through, because we have already decided that. So it was interesting. Relationships start off by where they're at and they're working their way towards the future. We started kind of at the future and made our way back to the present. And, you know, 18 years of marriage, now what, 27 years being together. It's been the joy of my life.
Well, since we're on the subject of marriage, we usually don't cover this till the end, but as a pastor, former singles pastor, what is the number one thing, or should I say number one thing you need to have for success, for a successful marriage? What is like the most important thing for a successful marriage?
I think the first thing that you have to have to have a successful relationship that will lead to a marriage is a whole heart. Love never comes in pieces. And I think what sabotages what could have been a tremendous relationship was that still there was some broken pieces in the soul of that person. And you will bring in those pieces into a relationship that started whole. And you will find yourself repeating what just took place in your last relationship. And so I say, get healed before you get into a relationship, because you're only going to sabotage you and yourself and this person by just offering pieces. That's the first thing. The second thing I would tell them is, are you attracted to one another physically? Because that's important. A lot of Christians don't like to talk about that. They're like, "Oh, I fell in love with their heart." Well, good, awesome. You know, I fell in love with their.
I feel like that wouldn't go over well. Like, if you were to say, "I'm like, what do you love about me?" It's like, "Do I look nice?" Oh, your heart is amazing.
Yeah, and it's almost like, well, you can, you know, yeah. And at the end of the day, you need to be attractive to them, because your eyes will wander. And if you remain, if you want to remain faithful to your spouse, she has, or he or she has to be the most attractive thing to you. Mike Tyson said it the best. He says, there's someone always better than you that's out there. There's always going to be somebody more attractive out there. But as long as you still have that attraction for that person that started off when you were dating and still continues as you're journeying, that person becomes the most beautiful person in your life. And so I think having a whole heart, you know, a healed soul, attraction. And I think it probably one of the most important thing is that, do your destinations match? Are you guys going in the same direction? Do you see a fit for the future? Again, going 10, 15 years into marriage, a lot of times people never discuss that. She had a career, he had a career. We're both going on separate paths, but we never talked about how those paths can lead in the same direction. And I would always say, you have to think futuristic. You have to take Jeremiah 29:11, that God has a future and it's filled with hope. Ask God, what does that future look like, and how, in some sense, can our futures fit together?
All right, so Jeremiah 29:11, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's the ultimate coffee mug verse.
Yeah. Right?
Also, I'm told it's widely misunderstood. That verse is delivered while the Israelites are in wandering in the wilderness, right? So not a great season for them. So when people say that God has a plan for your life, what does that mean?
Well, to put it in a practical sense, you know, when a new car comes out, we see the visible sign of what was a plan 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We see the manifestation of it. But if we looked deeper into it, and traced it back to its origin, it started with a plan. When I look at, when people sit there and say, God has a plan for your life, it is God, going back to my experience, saying, Obed, this is what I know you will encounter in the future. And this plan that I'm unfolding for your life right now that you're trusting me with, you may not understand it right now, but if you continue to go, it's going to make sense as you go. And I feel like oftentimes when we sit there as pastors say, God has a plan for your life, there's many people in our congregation saying, well, how is that for me? What is the plan for my life? And I really believe that comes back to going to your creator, going to the person you have a relationship with him and asking him. It's going to his word. And what does his word say about the plan that he has for my life? Plans to prosper, plans to grow, plans to love, plans to serve. There's all these different plans that God has for his people. But again, a lot of times we're looking for that tailor-made plan just for me. And if I can't find it, then it doesn't exist. And therefore, I'm disappointed at God because I don't believe he has a plan for my life. God does have a plan for your life.
So when things go wrong and we see, you know, premature death, we see massive career failures, bad decisions, is that the plan gone wrong? Was that part of the plan?
When it goes back to the plans, I can only go back to my own experiences. And at that moment, when each one of them died, I had no idea the plan. I was confused, Ryan, because I had a plan. Mm-hmm. My plan was my brother was going to get new lungs. I had a plan that, you know, my sister would overcome this brain hemorrhage because she was healed of lupus. And I quickly understood that my plan was not his plan. And then finding out a year later through my brother's caseworker, God's plan then made a lot more sense than my plan a year prior to that. And I would just encourage people to continue even if there's tragedy, or continue even though there's a setback, because that plan may have just been yours. And you'd realize if you stay in faith and you continue to trust, then ultimately you're going to see a plan in a different perspective and a different light. And I like to say it like this: God always has a different view of our life than we do. You know, I'm driving up to Big Bear and I stop at CVS right before you start the windy turn going up thousands upon thousands of altitude. And we walk in there, we pick up a bag, we picked up a bag of chips, some drinks, and we picked up some stuff for the cabin. And the next you know, we're 3,000 feet in our altitude. We stop, we take pictures. I look down and I see the CVS that just 15 minutes ago, I was in that store. Well, when I walked into that store was bigger than me. Mm-hmm. But when I was at a different altitude, I was bigger, or the sight was that store really isn't that big. And I kind of look at it like the way God looks at us. He's seeing it from a different view. Mm-hmm. And he sees a lot further than what we do. And I've learned, and I'm continually to learn to trust him, and know that he has the best plan for my life.
You mentioned people are looking for a custom tailored plan for their life. Do you think that God does call people to do specific jobs, roles, you know, activities?
Absolutely. That's in the Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was mentioning to you before we started this podcast, I was in a study in the book of Nehemiah. I mean, he was a cupbearer. I mean, he was living in the royalty of a king. You know, he had every meal. He lived in the best place, and God causes an interruption from his family that saw his city get torn down and all these different things. And he gets burdensome to go build something he was never qualified to do. There's nowhere in the book of Nehemiah that mentions that he was a masonry worker, that at one time he was a construction worker, that he was at one time a builder of gates. Yet God gave him an assignment to rebuild a city, which would have taken, which would take the fact that he'd have to rally people to build walls and repair gates. The crazy thing about it was that it was done in a historical time of 52 days. If you looked at the qualifications of Nehemiah, Nehemiah wasn't qualified because he didn't have that resume, which reminds us all the time that when we look at what's ahead of us and we measure it against the qualifications of what we think we have, and God calls us to something different, we talk ourselves out of it. Because at the end of the day, we're looking at it through our qualifications, when in some sense, God's looking at it through his plan. And Nehemiah was never a construction worker, but to be the cupbearer, he had to be a wise discerner and a builder of people. And so he built the people before they built the walls. And so at the end of the day, again, going back to, does God have specific plans for our life? Absolutely. But never look at them through your own qualifications. I mean, think of the disciples, you know, in Matthew chapter 4 or prior to these fishermen. Hey, guys, I'm going to call you to fish for men. And they're like, what? Did you add a vow to it or something like that? No, I'm going to cause you to fish for men. They were never in the fishing for men business. They were fishermen, but never in the fishing for men business. They didn't have the resume. You know, Matthew was a tax collector. Luke was a physician. You want me to what? Spread your gospel? Mm. I'm a tax collector. I'm a money person. I'm a doctor. I'm a physician. I am not a preacher. Yet they were called to a specific assignment. And I really believe that where we get lost in the translation is that we're always looking at it through the lens of our own qualifications, when we have to be reminded that God came and sent his son Jesus to requalify the disqualified. Sin disqualified us. Jesus came, died for us, requalified us, and yet calls us to a work that he has planned for our lives.
So there's precedent, it seems, biblically for God utilizing people who have no business doing what they're doing.
Yeah, if you want to put it that way, you know.
So if you feel underqualified, overwhelmed when you're attacking a certain problem, you may be in good company.
Yeah, and again, I think we marginalize our own selves. We talk ourselves out of things I really believe God's talking us into. And again, we're looking at it through a different lens than he is.
So I want to get to the Bible a little bit. How do you know the Bible is in effect true?
Well, going back to me being young and being the cynical person I was, the sarcastic person that I was, the Bible was a book. It was a book that mom read to us every night. It was a book that was in, you know, every room of our house. It was a book. And to billions of people today, it's still just a book. But that word is a living word. And when it became alive in my life, when I desperately needed a change in my life because the course I was headed towards, where prison saved me, it saved me from death. I knew that I tried everything. I tried drugs. I tried alcohol. And at the end of the day, it left me empty. And I decided, I'm going to try this book. I'm going to see if it works. And until this day, I'm still trying it.
So how does one try and see if the Bible works? What would be a few recipes one could try out?
You know, I think if you're right now, if you're going through confusion, why don't you pick a couple of scriptures and read them about peace? Or, you know, clarity of mind, or maybe read Proverbs and get some wisdom and understanding, and let that word resonate in you. Believe me, it doesn't stop in your mind. It will resonate with you. And again, try it. I would encourage people to try it. Listen, if you're going to go to Barnes & Noble and pick out a book to read, whether it's fictional or nonfictional, you made an attempt to try the book. And I would just encourage you to do the same thing. I was there.
I guess we do that with diet books, right? Or yeah, health guides.
Yeah, absolutely.
I read Men's Health, and there's always a more muscular model on the cover that claims if I do these five things, I'll resemble him. I'm actually pretty quick to adopt health tips. So, you know, maybe Proverbs is not such a bad suggestion. So do you think a lot of people just don't end up opening the book and trying? Do you think that's the, when people say, God, this is a weird book. It's been assembled over thousands of years. It's written by men. There's some inconsistencies in it. It's a weird book. Proverbs makes a lot of sense. Ezekiel, kind of bonkers when you read it. And you mentioned it's a living word to you. Do you think that would be the case for more people if they tried it out and they interacted with it more?
Yeah, and I think you brought up a great point when you brought up, you know, a diet book. You know, the one thing about the Bible is that it has no picture of a person in the front cover.
Yeah.
You know, so you're not going
Well, mine
to,
did. I have a special Bible. Yeah, well, and it's got some cool photos in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, you're not going to pick up a Bible and buy it because of a picture in the
That's
front.
Right.
The second thing is that, you know, if I picked up a dietary book or how to lose weight or how to gain muscle in my body, it's going to lead me down a quest of searching. I want to learn fruits. I need to know what type of fruits are going to be good for my body in a season that I'm in right now. What type of meats should I be eating? Where do those meats come from? Do I want Kobe beef? Do I want regular beef? What's the difference? We do this naturally when it comes to changing our life. The Bible, in some sense, from a Western perspective, can be confusing because it's written not just with content, but culture. And so a lot of us don't make the cultural connection with some of the content that is written. But if we did the research, let's just say that we would do if we were figuring out what kind of meat we're going to eat or what type of vegetables should we have that's going to work for where I'm at today when it comes to the body I'm trying to build, then at the end of the day, you're going to find that there is some great truths in there that you can apply to your life.
Why do you think we have to seek out the truth about it? One thing I've always struggled with is that some books like Proverbs, you know, Song of Solomon and Ecclesiastes, there's a lot of instant wisdom in there. Mm-hmm. And then other books, like we mentioned, you have to really know the cultural context and what was going on. And, you know, it's not until I opened up a commentary that I was able to see like, oh, I see the parables of the, you know, it oftentimes, especially with the prophets, right? God is telling a prophet, hey, go and like take a pot, put a bunch of bones in it and boil it.
Yeah.
And then point to the people and say, you're the bones in this pot. It's a very interesting way of doing things, right?
100%.
And I go, well, that doesn't really seem relevant. No one's really doing that today. So why doesn't God update it a little bit? Or why doesn't God, you know, update Revelation? Why are we using a book from thousands of years ago written to kind of one culture at the time to base our entire walk of life on?
Yeah, and you know, the beauty about the scriptures is that they transcend time and they transcend seasons and they transcend fads. The Bible is something that is consistent. And I think when we look for self-help books or we look for what can we do, read to improve our lives, you're not going to pick up a book 15 years that was written 20 years ago. It is going to be obsolete. And when you read the Bible, there's something about it that even though it was written 2,000 years ago in its cultural content, there are still some truths to it that you can apply today. Like, you know, we're not going to sit there and, you know, women, you sit on one side of the church and men, you got to sit on the other. That could be culturally extinct in certain places. But there's, when I went to South America with my grandmother and, you know, I was walking her in and we were there and I sat next to her. The pastor gently, politely tapped my shoulder and says, the men are on the other side. And I was like, no, I'm here with my grandma. She's your guest speaker. And then, you know, I looked at my grandma. My grandma gave me that look. And it really dawned on me that some parts of the world, it's still happening. Some parts of the world, there's bones being put in a pot. It just may not be here in America. So I try not to look at the Bible in a sense to where may God have done, whereas God has done things to, in some sense, throw the baby out with the bathwater. I would just sit there and go, man, he used that for that time. It doesn't mean that he'll use that particular thing for this time. I mean, I sure hope he doesn't tell me to get a pot and put bones inside of it.
That wasn't even the worst one in Ezekiel. Ezekiel, you know this.
Yeah.
He's got to lay on his side for 2 years. He has a side plank.
Yeah.
On his left and right side. Has to cook his food over human excrement.
Yeah.
But then he appeals that.
Yeah.
I read that. And God says, you're right. You have been good. You can use cow excrement instead. That was the reprieve you got.
Yeah.
It's weird, man. The book is, it's a really strange book.
It is.
But obviously we're still talking about it. And
absolutely. And it's still the number one seller every year.
Number one seller.
By far.
I know. All right. So another thing I want to ask you, because I always find this area interesting, is you mentioned and people who recognize there's another world. So kind of a weird topic that gets brought up in Christian circles too, is this idea of spiritual warfare. Mm-hmm. It seems hard to read the Bible without acknowledging with some specific verses, specifically our battle is not against flesh and blood, mm-hmm. But against the powers and principalities of the air. So what is spiritual warfare? Is that an allegorical thing? Do you think that's a real thing that's just like constantly going on around us? How do you view and interpret spiritual warfare?
Yeah, I think obviously going back to even how we were born, I mean, we were born spirit first, flesh second, and this was the reasoning of us having to be born again. Nicodemus talked about that. What do I need to do? Return back into my mother's womb and come out again? That's the question he asked Jesus. So we are spirit beings living in a body. We are of another world. You know, we are sent here on earth as our mission. God created the heavens for himself. He created the earth for his children. Be no different than, you know, us creating, you know, as parents, creating our home and then buying a home for our children where they can enjoy it. And so that fact that we are spirit beings before we were human beings lets us know that there is a spirit world. And again, I go back to those who are listening today that go, man, come on, are you serious? There's no denial that people know there is this other world or a world that there is a battle going on today. It's amazing in times that we're looking at today with the COVID, with the racism going on today and the injustices, that people who are far from God or far from a belief with God would say, this is satanic, or this is the work of the enemy. What enemy? What are you talking about? And so there is something in every single person that relates to another world, because we are spirit beings before we were human beings. And every one of us, even as kids, were searching. We all went through the phases of wanting to be superheroes, because the superhero came from another world, got supernatural power from another world. And so we're drawn to that. Why? Because there's something inside of us that we may have not paid a lot of attention to, because we're more focused on the exterior and not the interior. But I've talked to thousands of people who are not in faith that will tell me all day, oh, I know there's a spiritual warfare, or I know there is another world out there. I just don't know if I'm want to acknowledge it at this time. But I think there is, in some sense, within all of us, a sense of knowing that there's another world out there. There's another battle that's going on behind the scenes of the battle we're seeing right now.
And so if the Bible says, you know, resist the devil, the Bible says, you know, the battle is not flesh and blood, but, you know, there's a prayer component to that, to fighting this other realm. What is that? How does that practically work out then for a Christian then? How would one interpret what to do about spiritual warfare? Do you wake up and go, oh, there's an enemy, you know, I just pray against it? Or is there it's not something I actually need to worry about. It's more of this like, yeah, I'm not doing anything bad, so I'm not really inviting that. How do you work that out?
Well, and again, this all goes back to really getting to dive into the scriptures, understand it. Let's talk about that. Resist the devil. Well, who is the devil? First of all, you'd ask that question. And we all know it's Lucifer, one of the three distinct angels that God created, distinctively different from others. So God created Lucifer, which was the worshiper, Michael, which is the fighter, and Gabriel, who is the messenger. One day, Lucifer gets jealous of God, and God throws him out with another group of angels. Okay, so all that heaven is left with now is Michael, the fight, and Gabriel, the message. So God decided, you know what? I'm missing worship. I'm a God that wants to be worshiped. So he made man for its one purpose, and that was to be a worshiper of him, that we would worship the name that's above every name. So why does the devil hate us? Because we have the ability to do something he's prohibited of doing. At one time, he had the ability to do. And he's not a devil, he's an angel. And the Bible says angels are beneath us. The Bible lets us know that angels only have the ability to see to the horizon. God never gave angels the ability to see into tomorrow. So we know that every time the devil, Lucifer, says, your tomorrow is going to be jacked up. Well, we know that's a lie because, again, angels are only have the ability to see to the horizon. So when we talk about resist the devil, we really got to think the context of who our enemy is. A, he's been defeated. Secondly, he's beneath us. Thirdly, God has given us the authority and the power to overcome who he is. And fourthly, which I think is probably the primarily and the most important, is that God does the battles for us. And so when I think about spiritual warfare, I'm not thinking in the context of, to me, that I have to fight to make something happen. No, I think I got to take my rightful place of being a believer, given keys to the kingdom, and having the authority that has been delegated to me, and coming in the name that has already defeated him at the grave.
Mm. It's interesting. You said we're made to worship. I've heard that a lot, and I've always had a tough time wrestling with that. I like to believe we have a bunch, you know, we have free will and we get to choose, but if we were made to do something specifically, it makes me wonder, do we actually have a choice? Like, if we're made to do something and we veer away from that, then, and obviously worshiping takes many expressions.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's why we're all, I mean, I believe that, you know, regardless of where you come at Christianity, we love musicians and actors and actresses and movies, and we become fans real quick.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But I'm going, if I was made to worship, do I actually have that much free will? That's always been interesting. If we were made to do something specific like that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, I look at it, you know, I look at my son, you know, he, you know, always tells me, Dad, I'm going to be the pastor. And I'm like, well, son, you could be anything you want. You know, mm-hmm. You know, this doesn't have to be passed to you. I'm pretty sure other people can take it. And now he's been telling me, I want to be a business person. I want to make a lot of money. And then recently he already wrote a script, and I want to be a producer.
How old is your son?
He's 10 years old.
Okay. I was going to say, he said he was like 32.
No, yeah, he's 10 years
Sounds
old.
Sounds like my friends.
Yeah. And and the awesome thing about it is that whatever my son does will bring a glory to my wife and I. Mm-hmm. And I think when God says, you were created to worship, worship is larger than the expression of hands lifted, songs being sung. I think when we go out and do what he has placed a passion in our life to do, it is bringing glory to him. And that's what I would use the word worship. You know, I wouldn't use the word worship and just marginalize it to the context of us singing a couple of songs. I would sit there and say that every day I get to worship him in all that I do. And that is just bringing glory. And most importantly, a smile on his face saying, that's my child and he's living for me.
Mm. Last question. What What is the biggest issue you see that transcends your congregation? And just when you meet people, what is the number one thing that people are struggling with right now that you see? And how do you address that as a pastor?
I think today what our times and what we're going through today has really illuminated in people's lives was, what is my purpose? Mm-hmm. And why am I here? I don't think there's ever been a time, at least I was born, where we were shut down for 3 months. We couldn't leave our homes. We couldn't go to work. We did everything via Zoom, technology wise. And I think a lot of people had a lot of time. You know, the enemy to your soul is hurry. And everybody's in a hurry. They want to get there fast. And we slowed down. We actually stopped. And I think a lot of people got a great picture of what their soul looks like. And I think at the end of the day, they realized a few things. Number one, what I'm doing today, is it significant? Number two, what I'm doing today, is it making a difference? And number three, what I'm doing today, is it the legacy I want to leave? And I think people are really asking the right questions right now. I think with everything that's happening, is causing us to come to the table, but more importantly, take an inner look at our soul and see and notice how disconnected we have been, because we've connected ourselves to hurriness, to busyness. And we've rewarded busyness when busyness is the opposite of fruitfulness. And so at the end of the day, I think that we're hearing more and more, what more can I add to my life that will have significance? I lead a Bible study on a Wednesday morning and Thursday morning with high achievers. And all of their businesses are booming right now, but there's still that dissatisfaction in them. And they're realizing more and more that I want to attach myself to something that's significant, that is going to actually make a huge difference. And I believe the stage has been set. I believe in the midst of chaos, Christ is magnified. And I really believe that what the enemy meant for bad, God's going to turn it around for the good. But he's just looking for people. And we always have to remember that leadership is at its best when problems are at its worst. And God is always looking for that leader, never in a good time, but in a bad time. We look at the Bible. When these men and women arose to greatness, was pendant on the magnitude of the problem that they were called to solve. And so I have a different outlook on what's going on today. People are saying, oh, things are going bad, man. It's so bad. We're so divided. I'm going, whoa, the opportunity for leaders to rise out of the ashes right now, that in the next year, there are going to be people you never heard of that are going to be at the front line of these solutions. And then if you trace it back, you're going to see that all this time that they went through, God was preparing them for what he had prepared for them.
That's nice. I like hearing a little optimism right now.
Yeah.
A lot of negativity out there.
Yeah. Lots of it.
That's great. Well, this has been awesome. Thank you so much. We covered spiritual warfare, marriage. I know they're not the same thing, but biblical inerrancy. Thank you so much for listening to Kinda Christian. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review.